remember the scheme of things. This is section Gimel in Be'er Beis, for those of you who are following this format. Again, the scheme of things here is that the Sefer is dealing with the words of the Chachamim, and one of the basic things you have to deal with are surprises that may be found in the words of the Chachamim. Words of the Chachamim, whether words of Agada, or as we talked about last week and we're talking about again this week, words of straight halacha that produce a result that's extremely surprising and extremely counterintuitive to our first reaction. And that, of course, would be a strong basis for people to being skeptical about Divrei Chazal, about the words of the sages and their teachings. And so, the Maral wants to deal with it, and the din which he's going to... Last week we talked about this idea that the scheming, plotting witnesses are only going to get the punishment if they planned it and were successful to the point of getting the Bezin to decide it. But if the Bezin implemented it already, so then they're off the hook, which seems very, very strange. Usually it's the opposite. So we had the whole discussion last week about that, which we will not review today. It's not that it's forbidden for you to review, but it's just we're not going to review it today. Some hold that it's forbidden. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin another din, which is very surprising, which is, as he says, Omar Rav Kahana, Sanhedrin shiro kulam l'chayva paitrim isai. If the Sanhedrin was unanimous in its condemnation of a certain person who comes before them for judgment, so what do? We let him off the hook. It's only if the Sanhedrin had voices of dissent, voices that argued for his innocence in the process, then we would punish him if the majority concluded concluded that he was chayev. However, if this was a slam dunk, if this was a prosecutor's dream, it's an executioner's nightmare. If it's a prosecutor's dream, if it's so clear and obvious, so to speak, that the Sanhedrin has no voice speaking on behalf of the defendant, so then we will let the person off the hook. And of course, this is extremely surprising, counterintuitive. I think last time when we brought this up as one of the issues that the Maral is going to deal with down the line, so we talked about the fact that when we deal with, this is not required in the cases of judges, but in the cases of juries, where the logic is that a person is being judged by their peers, so the rule is that unless it's unanimous, we're not going to, right? Usually it has to be a unanimous verdict from the ladies and gentlemen of the jury. But over here, by the Sanhedrin, we have a very opposite perspective. V'adover tzarech Talmud. It requires understanding, it requires explanation why on earth it should be this way. So the Maral, as perhaps you may have become accustomed, has a two-tiered approach to this. He has two explanations that are hinging on one idea, one basic principle, but again, it expresses itself, or the issues that he raises are twofold within this process. And the basic principle that the Maral says here, and it's very, very poignant, very poignant. If those of you who are, again, who are looking inside, I would like to point you to the part in the end, where he says a sentence that summarizes the approach which he's going to take, although it does not at all touch upon the details. And the sentence, those of you who are using the Hartman edition, the Machon Yerushalayim edition, is on page Kuf Mem Dalet, the second column, the fourth line. V'chi bishvil ze shehu rasha yetei habezdin mimasha ro'i. There's no argument over here, says the Maral fundamentally, that this person is innocent because everybody says that he's guilty. Come on. Of course, if everybody says that he's guilty, so then presumably that's much more of a reason to say that he's guilty. However, Beis Din has a specific role and a specific methodology. And just because this man is guilty, we are not going to compromise Beis Din's role and Beis Din's methodology that they should go and change what they are because of what he is. What does that mean? That means that this kind of a process, where the person's going to come into Beis Din and everybody's going to say guilty, and they're going to say pretty much guilty right away, and it's going to close down the din, and there won't be process, and there won't be arguments for his good, this would be a compromise of the way Beis Din is classically supposed to function, and therefore we will not do it. We will not have the Beis Din do it. Premise that we must reestablish again is, as the Maharal has told us when we talked about last week's, where we said also, I mean, come on, if they're causing that this person, if they actually cause that the person should get killed, they should get less punished. He says, remember. We're talking here only about one sphere of response to the actions of a person. A person won't get punished in Beis Din, so that means that they're off the hook, that means that they're scot-free. I mean, if we believe that, we wouldn't be able to wake up in the morning. We believe that there's an ultimate din, la'asid lavai, there's an ultimate din in the world of eternity, different than this world. So the parameters of what the Beis Din does and what the Beis Din performs is not the be-all and end-all of judgment that exists in the world. The Beis Din has a specific sphere in which they judge, in which they do, and where it's not appropriate for the Beis Din to do it, so then it's left to the ultimate judge, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whether he will judge them in the world to come, or whether he will use, as the Gemara says in many places, the many agents which he has, where a person, Lailenu, who's supposed to get stoned, you know, the punishment deserves a stoning in Beis Din, that kind of stone, so he'll be walking down a mountain slope, and he'll slip and he'll fall, and rocks will come tumbling after him, or you know, other such unhappy endings that could be engineered by Hashem with His divine providence to make what needs to happen happen. But we're not so completely hinged on the Beis Din. So again, this is very much the abstract. We haven't gotten into the details at all. But the notion, what he's saying over here, is that this kind of a situation, where it's going to be a slam dunk judgment without much in the way of trying to find zechus, is not appropriate to be a process that would take place in the Beis Din. It is not fitting with the character of the Beis Din, and therefore the Beis Din will not be the agent for judgment here. Judgment will come from other quarters. Yes?
Just to clarify, if let's say they do have lots of discussions, someone says, maybe he's innocent, maybe he's not, but then in the end, everybody agrees that he's guilty, does he get killed in such a case?
I think so. I think that it's only the only time we say the Beis Din Shiro Kulam L'chaiva is where they didn't come around, where they didn't even begin with zechus. If in the end they agreed, so then I think that there is. It's just that there's going to be a process, and we'll see more about this. So the Maharal, in explaining this to the details, so why is this out of character for the Beis Din? Why is it out of character for the Beis Din to have this kind of a slam dunk? So the Maharal, and here's where we get to the Maharal, the Maharal's two components. And let's speak about one at a time. The first component the Maharal uses, we can summarize by the first teaching, when we get to the actual verbal teachings in Pirkei Avos, which was teaching of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly. What was their first teaching? First teaching, everybody has gotten this far. Hevu Mesunim Bedin. Be deliberate in judgment. That's the first teaching of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. What's the nature of that teaching? Hevu Mesunim Bedin. Take your time. Think about it. Okay, so look, everybody will tell you that. You should always take your time and think about things. The idea that we say Hevu Mesunim Bedin, however, is more than just, you know, good advice. As many times, you know, we could read the Mishnayos in Pirkei Avos and just see it as just, you know, a nice bunch of advice. And I think I've told you before, I've seen this, some of you before, for many years I recoiled from teaching Pirkei Avos because I couldn't get past this. You know, it sounds like a lot of nice things, you know, kind of things that, you know, your father might tell you, your friend might tell you, your teacher might tell you, Confucius might say, you know, like where's the Torah here, right? When you learn it a little bit, so for me it was, actually my father urged me to teach Pirkei Avos, and it opened up a whole new world to see that it's not just that. So what's the not just that of Hevu Mesunim Bedin? What's the depth of Hevu Mesunim Bedin? So the Maharal explains and excuse me if this sounds a little bit familiar, okay? Because the concept of Hevel Mesunim Badin is a concept of human struggles and human challenges in being able to arrive at wisdom. And we've been talking about that really since day one of learning the Be'er Hagola, where we're talking about the wisdom of the sages. Says the Maharal, we have to understand that true wisdom, true understanding, is not necessarily, is necessarily not instinctive, intuitive for us as people as we are. Seichel, wisdom, intellect, struggles with chomer, with our physical being, and with our self-motivated and self-serving and self-ish humanity. Those two things struggle with each other. They, to a certain degree, collide with each other and compete with each other. And for a person to arrive at wisdom, they have to be able to somehow peel through that, get through those layers. We have a term which we speak about of amelus b'torah, toiling in Torah, yigia, struggle, in order to be able to arrive at proper conclusions in Torah. Why is that such a fundamental concept? And it is an extremely fundamental concept. Last week we read the second parsha, the major parsha that introduced the blessings and the curses. Im bechukosai teilechu, if you go in my chukim, says Rashi, what does that mean? It doesn't mean just doing the mitzvahs. It means shetiu amelim b'torah, that you will toil in Torah. Toiling in Torah, la'asok b'divrei sora, which is also some kind of a such term, which implies that kind of an idea, is fundamental to the exercise. Why? Because toil, the struggle, is where we somehow have to delve to that which doesn't come so naturally. That which has to be uncovered. So that we have be'emes, truly, true wisdom in that sense. The Rav Huttner has a beautiful, beautiful mimer. I would not have thought by myself to connect this. I want to give credit, and there's much credit which has to be given that has never gone said to Rabbi Hartman and his footnotes. He is metzayin this. He notes this mimer from the Rav Huttner in footnote 142. Rav Huttner in Shavuos, in his volume on Shavuos, has a beautiful mimer where he talks about Amelus B'Torah, and he makes the following point, and this is a very Shavuos relevant point. The Gemara teaches us that every time a person studies Torah, they're supposed to study it be'ema, be'yira, be'reses, u'vizia. They're supposed to study it with fear, with trembling, with awe, with shaking. What does that mean? Why should they study it that way? Because they're supposed to study it now in the year 5766 the same way it was first heard and learned in the year 2448 when the Torah was given at Sinai. Kinesinasa, as it was originally given. Now, you and I understand that we don't generally study Torah this way. And in fact, if we want to point to a time when that changed, so we could look at the Gemara in Megillah, which says that once upon a time, the Jews, when they studied Torah, they were always standing up, which perhaps would be the most, you know, before you start being fearful, before you start trembling, just, you know, stand up with respect. They used to stand and learn because that was the posture. It's as if you're hearing it from Hashem. That's why we stand when we read the Aseres Hadibros with the special cantillation, with the special trup on Shavuos, because it's like we're trying to reenact Har Sinai where Hashem was talking to us. So we stand up. We used to do that until the days of Rav Gamliel. In the days of Rav Gamliel, people became weak. They weren't able to handle the intensity. Just like at Har Sinai, the Jewish people couldn't handle the intensity for the long term, and they said, you know what, we can't hear from Hashem anymore, let's hear from you, Moshe. In the days of Gamliel, they couldn't even handle the intensity when they were learning of having it with such power. So they started sitting. And that's what it says, Mishameis Rav Gamliel, says the Gemara, Botel Kovet HaTorah. When Rav Gamliel died, the honor of Torah, so to speak, petered out. Right? Rav Gamliel was the transition in that, when people were still able to have it that way. So the Gemara says that you have to study Torah with that fear and with trembling, and therefore the Gemara says there are certain states of affairs that would forbid a person from being able to study Torah. This was again, also, you can say this is indicative of the those days. Takanas Ezra was Tfilas Ezra, that a person would not be able to study Torah after they had had intimate relations until they went to the mikveh. A Balkeri, anybody who had that kind of a discharge from their body could not study Torah until they went to the mikveh. Why? So it was related to this idea. Because it was understood that the person would not be as focused and as much in a posture of the fear and trembling before Hashem that would be appropriate for learning. So they have to transition from that by virtue of the tefillah. Now that also, parenthetically, also is not something which is practiced as absolute halacha today, and one can, the Gemara says, was the Efshar Lamad, but it would also seem to be related to this kind of a thing, like this going from standing to sitting. The standard now of learning is unfortunately different than it was. However, the Gemara says that Birigilin, when you have something that you've already learned a few times, and you're sort of just reviewing it, going over it, going over the words, so then it's no problem. That can be done even without having gone to the mikveh. That can be done in a different, under different circumstances. Why? There's no requirement over there of kinesinasa. There's no requirement over there that has to be with the fear and the trembling and so on and so forth. Rav Huttner says basically the idea is because in that stage, it's not Torah with amelus b'tayra. It's not Torah with toil. Torah with toil has all of that idea of Mamar Har Sinai. Mamar Har Sinai was dramatic. The Jewish people at Har Sinai understood that when they were getting this piece of Torah, this was an awakening. This was a discovery. This was something that was going piercing inside them that they had never had before. It was literally traumatic. Chazal say that when Hashem's voice came out to the Jewish people at Har Sinai, they died. Their souls left them. He had to breathe life back into them so then he could tell them another commandment and have them die again. It was like a CPR, right? They had 600,000 defibrillators. It was HaKadosh Baruch Hu was coming now to the core of their essence. And Amelus B'Torah is a humanly simulated version of that. Where you understand, you know, it's not, okay, here we go, let's hear this thing again, just, you know, some more information, something like that. But the idea is that to be able to arrive at the Chachmah, at the wisdom, I have a lot of work to do. It doesn't come naturally to me. Because I have to somehow pierce through all of the other things, which are my motivations, which are within me, which are part of my personality and character, that are not intuitive to wisdom, not intuitive to Hashem's wisdom. Matan Torah showed the Jewish people very, very well that Torah was not natural to the physical beings that they had become. And indeed, Amelus B'Torah, the way we're supposed to do it, where we don't just sit and, you know, just, you know, absorb it, you know, like, okay, I heard this interesting thing, but that we work in order to be able to really integrate the wisdom, that is the character of how a Jew studies. So that's how Rav Huttner explains, that when the person has gone through that process already, and the nature of the person's learning at this point, or even if the person hasn't gone through it, but the nature of the person learning is already, this is familiar, they've already been there, and so on and so forth. At that point, that amelus factor is not there. At that point, whatever they've broken through that particular wall within them on this piece of learning, and therefore, it doesn't have the same context, and it doesn't require the same efforts, and it doesn't require the same ambiance of learning that normal learning does. Torah doesn't come naturally. The wisdom doesn't come naturally. Now, it wasn't always this way. It wasn't always this way at all. Adam HaRishon, when he was created, before he ate from the Eitz Hadas, it's exactly the opposite case. Adam HaRishon, before he ate from the Eitz Hadas, we understand that his intuition was completely Torah. Hashem blew into him in a Shama. The body shrunk in its significance. It was not a factor relative to what the neshama motivated. And Adam HaRishon was, in the words of the Ramban, Poel Emes Shepuloso Emes. He saw the truth, which he borrows from Kiddush Levana, from the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. He was true. He was true to his task. His actions were true. They were accurate. Everything was on the nose. Because it was indeed part of the original intuition of man. And we've talked about the fact that inside the heart of a person, inside the neshama of the person, b'ficho v'lvavcha, is that wisdom. The great ones were able to somehow discover that intuition. Avram Avinu knew Torah. Says the Medrash, from where did Avram Avinu knew Torah? Who taught him Torah? His insides taught him Torah. His kloyos, his kidneys, whatever it is that which gave him wisdom. That which distinguishes, right? The kidneys are filters, right? They got it. He got it intuitively. He understood. But the whole idea of how things developed were that after the Avos and the Jewish people went down to Egypt and they became clouded and cluttered over with other things that blocked wisdom and made the introduction to wisdom a struggle. And there the voice of Hashem came from the outside at Har Sinai. And that has become the character of Talmud Torah. A struggle in order to be able to discover. Says the Maharal that the Beis Din, Hevu Misunim Badin, has to, of course, have this character. They have to have this character of working to arrive at conclusions. Because that's the human way of learning. That's the way that a Beis Din learns. The Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, taught this as their first teaching in Pirkei Avos. Why is that? So here again, I just ask you to consider ideas that we have discussed earlier in this process. And again, these ideas will continue to crop up because we're talking about one theme, and that is the wisdom of the sages. And the wisdom of the sages really came to the fore when? At the time of the men of the Great Assembly. Because who was dominant in the first temple? Before the men of the Great Assembly took over at the beginning of the period of the Second Temple. The Nevi'im were what was dominant. The prophets. The prophets had trauma and difficulty of their own. When they got their prophecy, what happened? Down for the count. Right? They had to have it either in a dream, or they were thrown into some kind of a fit, a spell, because getting that spiritual communication is not something that a standing, conscious, human, physical being with all of the physical things going on is able to do. So it knocked them out. But in the end, right, it was a gift from Hashem. They got it, and they had it right away. When prophecy ceased with the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, pretty much, as the men of the Great Assembly took over and it became the period of the Chachamim, it's not okay like at Har Sinai where that, or like the prophets where that trauma is just done by Hashem and you, Lemaisa, in the end you have it delivered to you. They had to work it and they had to develop it and they had to bring it out. And so the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah gave as their first instruction, Hevu Misunim Badin. You must be deliberate in your judgment. You must understand, now this is the period where we don't have the prophets, where we only have the wisdom that is going to be through the process of conscious, intellectual discovery, study, and you've got to understand that that's not a flash. That doesn't come quickly. Now, it is true that the prophets were not teaching Torah. They were not teaching Torah. The prophets taught God's general guidance. They couldn't teach halachas. They couldn't introduce new halachas. But the prophets did judge. Right? The Devora HaNeviya was a shofetes. Shmuel HaNavi, his calling card was the fact that he traveled around the Jewish people and judged from place to place. And we have to understand that indeed that judgment was not completely with his Navi hat off. In fact, the Gemara tells us that one of the characteristics of the Melech HaMashiach, when the Mashiach will come, the king will be Mayrach V'Do'in. He'll shmek. Anybody know what shmek means? Right? He'll shmek means he'll smell it out and he'll judge with a sense of smell. In other words, instant. There will be something of that immediate divine inspiration. But the Beis Din that we talk about here, the regular Sanhedrin, is indeed standing as the cognitive, intellectual, those that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola were speaking to. And they're doing it not with the flash of prophecy. They're doing it with the struggle of wisdom. Says the Maharal that there's a din, you know, that for a court, the Torah legislates, that there has to be halonas hadin. I mean, this is like the, sort of like the practical way to explain it. When you're dealing with dinei nefashas, this rule, by the way, of the slam dunk is especially for dinei nefashas, for capital cases. Maharal says, for capital cases, obviously we're going to deal with it with greater gravity in the sense that it's irreversible. For financial cases, you know, it's a reversible din. You can always have somebody pay it back. You can't have somebody bring someone back to life. So he says the Maharal, we know by the dinei nefashas, there's a din of halonas hadin, which means the Beis Din can't decide the case that day. If the case is brought before them, they discuss it. If they seem to be coming to a conclusion, it doesn't make any difference. They say, sorry, no vote, no conclusion, sleep on it. And when we're going to come back tomorrow, and we're going to talk about it again, and there'll be new ideas and new insights and new arguments that are going to be brought to the fore, and then we will decide. Why, says the Maharal, why is that so essential? It's because of this idea. Din, wisdom, doesn't come naturally. So you got to take time, and you got to work it through. Says the Maharal, tell me something. If everybody saw l'chaiva, so when you're going to leave it over for the next day, that's a formality. It's not real. It's not like people are going to be really reconsidering. Everybody sees it the same way. So again, you're just judging with instinct. That's not a Beis Din. It may not be. Again, get us right. That this guy, we're saying, for any reason, we say, oh, now we think he's innocent because they just said it instinctively and therefore they've got to be wrong. Of course, he's most definitely guilty. I mean, we're not sure, but more definitely probably than when they have a discussion and they have a vote and it ends up 40 to 30, right, in the Beis Din. It's probably more likely that this guy's guilty than the guy with the 40 to 30, even though the guys with the 40 to 30, they work through it more. However, the Beis Din stands for something. And that something is the development of understanding by people. And when Beis Din acts instinctively, they betray that character. So again, if you will say, and because of that, the man walks out free? Walks out free. The Lord is waiting in the wings. He's going to pick him off. Right? Whether he's going to pick him off bezeh in this world, or he's going to pick him off bebah, whatever. But don't worry, he's going to get his due. And caveat two, which we said last week, which the Maharal says here as well, is that of course if the Beis Din feels that in a societal manner that this will cause havoc, that the person stands as a danger and so on and so forth, they have the right to act extrajudicially, so to speak, and do it and say, look, you know, as a governing authority, we have to make sure that this person is out of the way. But in terms of the pure din, the way a Beis Din stands is with thoughtful judgment, because wisdom does not come to us naturally. It does not come to us instinctively. It requires toil. It's not muskal rishon. First idea of the Maharal. What do your instincts tell you about that? What do you think? What do you think? Is it good? You hear it?
Is this related at all to Chazal, which says that Sanhedrin never paskin capital punishment in 100 years?
The Maharal is going to talk about that more related to the second thing, to the second consideration. But yes, this discussion is related to that.
Isn't it a little hard to understand that if they have to have two agents? How do I give us so? It had to be talked to the viewer. You have all these things. It's like, what argument could you possibly come up with to say that he's innocent in such a situation?
There were still arguments. There were still arguments.
Right.
It's very, very clear there were still arguments. There were still arguments.
It's interesting that you left develop the wisdom for each particular case, but you assume that based on being around and working in them for a while, so that their wisdom would
right.
improve, but also in each case that they would come with.
Right, it's a good point. That's a very, very good and an important point to bring out. We're not talking here where the Sanhedrin is necessarily creating new law or judging very, very novel things. It's just another case, another application. But nevertheless, that's the nature of the dinan. They're supposed to be misunim. They're supposed to be deliberate. They have to be human beings understanding that they're human beings and acting as human beings. With wisdom. Reason two. Consideration number two of the maral. Okay, and the Republicans in the room will forgive him. The Beis Din is supposed to be a Beis Din Tzedek. What does it mean, a Beis Din Tzedek? Tzedek, Tzedek, Tirdof. There's a remarkable thing which you see in the halachas of the Sanhedrin. And this, we're dealing here again with dinei nefashos, with capital cases. Because when you're dealing with monetary cases, there's no such thing as being lenient or being strict. Because when you're lenient for A, you're strict for B. It's between two people. We're talking about capital cases. And that is that the Beis Din is commanded and is mandated, and it expresses itself in its laws to try to find the person innocent. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. You're supposed to pursue tzedek. You're supposed to pursue righteousness. Tzedek yolinba. The halacha is that if the Beis Din paskins that a person is innocent, and then somebody comes chasing after the Beis Din, screeching around the curve like our Eden Zomim last time, and they say, one second, I have an argument that he should be guilty. We say, sorry, we already paskin innocent, the case is closed. But if Beis Din paskin guilty, and somebody comes even tiptoeing around the corner, we'll say, hold it. Hold it. Let's listen to what this person has to say. They're slanted. The first arguments that are made have to be arguments for the person's innocence. The Eda will judge and the Eda will save. The Gemara understands all of these things as the Beis Din having a mandate to try to produce good. To produce good, what do you mean to produce good? To produce good the way you and I and the person who never studied Torah and who doesn't have sophisticated philosophical interpretations of good means good. Which means that the guy doesn't get his head chopped off, but the guy goes out free and go and buy a Slurpee. That's the mandate that we see, the weighted mandate of the Beis Din. Not heaven forbid. Not heaven forbid that the Beis Din is supposed to say, okay, fine, it's okay. It has to be arguments for tzedek. It has to be arguments for righteousness. And when we say that, oh, they already decided that the person is innocent, and now somebody comes and argues, well, one second, maybe the person's guilty. Again, the judgment was finished. So we say, look, we already did it. We don't necessarily have an obligation to reopen the case. It's not, again, that we're necessarily going to be completely saying, forget it, let's just slant this whole thing for tzedek. But within the confines of doing what can be considered a basically correct and accurate judgment, we definitely are trying to give a greater time and a greater opening and a greater coverage to the side of tzedek, to the side of innocence.
But when you say that when it comes to money judgments, dini mamnos, so this doesn't apply because being lenient to one is being
strict to the other.
Strict to the other. But isn't the same true with dini nefashos? If a person is accused of murder, so whether they're let off or they're punished has an impact on the family of the victim, has an impact on society. It has an impact, and people are going to look, are going to react and respond in a certain way. It's not just between that individual and God. So being lenient to him has a deplorable, horrible, negative impact on others, but I don't want my Republicanism to show.
Okay. So the thing is like this. In a broader sense, of course you are correct. In a broader sense, in terms of society, yes, you are correct. And as I mentioned a little bit before, and bears mention again, there has to be, besides looking at the narrow din, the Sanhedrin, the Melech. I think I mentioned to you a number of sessions back, we talked about the Sanhedrin, the dichotomy that the Ran makes, that we do that, right? That there is a governmental, a policy kind of a layer that also has to be measured. You know, if people are going to be just going free all the time, so then anarchy can prevail, and you know, in that broader sense, and you know, we're going to touch upon that also soon when we speak about that mention which Rabbi Schechter made before of the Chazal. There has to be that presence as well for the family in a more immediate sense. But when we look very, very specifically at this din, you know, the family is in the bleachers. You know, this is the state versus so and so. This isn't a civil case, and therefore it's different. It's a different posture and a different situation. The Gemara considers it to be different. It's the Bezdin and the person. It's not these two people against each other. The Torah clearly does mandate this tzedek.
What about Dinei Isser? That also would seem to be between just Rishnei Treif. Do we give him Malkus? That's also
right. It's going to be carrying a lot of the same rules. It's not necessarily exactly the same, but a lot of the same rules apply. Katla Kula, Katla Palga. You see in the Gemara. You know, it's like a partial killing, so to speak. Now, so the Maral explains this, and he says very, very simply, and here the line is as follows: Ke'abezdin roi shiyu tzadikim v'yisharim min atzadik v'yosher enei bo mimenu be'etzem rak hatov. Because the Bezdin are not supposed to be just impassive intellectuals who are able to see through to the truth as clearly as possible. If that's the case, innocence and guilt stand on equal footing, and you see them both exactly the same way. The Bezdin, Talmidei Chachamim, are supposed to be tzaddikim. They're supposed to be righteous people. And righteous people like to and are motivated to do goodness and kindness. So what are they supposed to do? They're supposed to check that at the door, and when they're in the Bezdin, they're supposed to be just straight people seeing truth and falsehood? In a certain sense, yes, they are supposed to do that. For instance, if they have the Baron Jacob de Rothschild or Edmund de Rothschild versus Schmerl the water carrier, and Schmerl the water carrier hasn't done very, very well since plumbing was installed, right? So he's collecting tzedakah from this judge who's a nice person and a tzaddik, and he gives him tzedakah every day when he comes and asks him for tzedakah. But when he sits in the court, he's not supposed to do that. He's supposed to say, whatever the case is, if he's right, he's right. If he's wrong, I'm going to award that $100 to Edmund de Rothschild, who, you know, who needs that $100 like Olmed, but to the Shmerl the water carrier, $100 is the food budget for the next month. Doesn't make a difference. I have to do din. But on the other hand, what do I do with my motivation for tzedek? What do I do when I have somebody standing in front of me? I have my motivation for tzedek. Says the Gemara, says the Pasuk, when it says v'itzilu ha'eda, that you're still supposed to be the tzaddik, the judge. Not the impassive arbiter, not the referee. But you're a tzaddik, you're dealing here with people to whom you want to give good. And therefore that's part of the fabric of how a Bezdin will function. When it's Edmund versus Shmerl, they can't do that because, again, they're coming here for din, they're not coming here for tzedakah. And giving him the $100, taking away from him the $100, that's also not right. That's Robin Hood, that's not our version and our understanding of tzedakah. But when you're coming to talking about you having the choice between killing somebody and helping somebody and saving somebody, everything about the personality of this person needs to be motivated to save him, except his desire for judgment. Says the Gemara that if the Beis Din just starts off from the beginning saying this guy's guilty, forget about it, he's got to die, then you get this sense that this is a bench that has a quick trigger finger and they have an easy time condemning people. And the same way that in the first interpretation of the Maharal we said it can't be so quick, because you have to understand they're supposed to be deciding what's right, what's correct, what's wise, what's true. And what's right, correct, wise, and true doesn't come quickly to people. You also have to say that these people are people who don't like to kill, who don't like to punish. And therefore, that has to be the character of the Beis Din. And if it comes too quickly, then it betrays the true character of what a Beis Din is supposed to be, which are tzaddikim doing what's right. Says Maral, so hold on, but one second. So you're saying to me that anarchy should reign. You're saying we should never want to punish, we should never want to kill, because, you know, we just want to do good. We just want to be nice. We want to be a very, very liberal bench. No. It is true, says the Maral. When you don't find zechus, when you don't find a justification for the person, so you judge the person l'chayv, you declare the person guilty. That's good also. When you get rid of the evil that exists in the world, that's an ultimate good. But v'dover zeh b'mikra kasher lo yimtza zechus. Says the Maharal, that's b'mikra. When there's no other way, this is your only chance, this is your only option, so then look, I have to do bad. You know, if you have your child and you care about your child and you're not having struggles with your temper, getting things out of your system, but you be'emes, truly, truly love your child and have no internal issues that make you for some reason want to strike out, which is extremely, extremely unusual. Extremely unusual. Right? Most times when people strike out against their children, you know, it's not a Beis Din. You know, it's an instinct. It's a frustration. It's a hard day at the office or whatever. Just tried to balance the checkbook or whatever it is. But let's say, so how does a person go? So they try to do good and they try to do right. And they try that they should be able to be kind and nurturing and helpful to the child. And if all else fails, and they say that we have to punish, so we punish. And you have to be able to do that. If you don't do that, then you're not a parent, right? Then you're just a sugar daddy, whatever you would call it. You're just doting, and you're not taking the role of discipline. But it's not a rush to discipline. It's a wisdom and a careful, slow walk to discipline. When you need to, you do it. But you don't rush to do it. The one who's too quick, too easy, too ready to do it, one questions necessarily whether the necessary nurturing ava is there for the child. Says the Maharal, that's what we're dealing with over here as well. I'm not talking about rules. Don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about rules, that you only make rules if you're really cruel. Otherwise, you say there are no rules that apply. I'm talking about punishments.
But if you're talking about the members of Sanhedrin, whom you said weeks ago would be able to retire in the sheretz,
right?
You're talking about Gedolim who are able to, who therefore under any circumstances, would be able to come up with arguments to say that this person is innocent.
That's correct.
And therefore, when would there ever be a case when they would just run out of arguments and, you know, be able to say, well, we tried, but this person is just a Russia, and so...
If they are able to. They have to have the capability to. This fellow walks into court, right? he's still smearing the blood, you know, onto his pants, right? And he's sharpening his knife, you know, for the next kill. They aren't necessarily inclined to. That's the din of Yitzilu Eida. What you're saying is, you got to be krum. You got to try any which way. Krum means a little twisted, a little strange, a little distorted. If that's what it takes, try to find. But if the Bezdin isn't doing that, and they just say, forget it, he's guilty. And they, you know, everything that they're doing is a formality, a joke, right, in their mind. So then forget it. Right? Then we don't have that idea that the Bezdin is punishing B'daychak. Let me just, if I may, I just want to follow through to that idea, because I'm willing to stay a little more and take questions. We're going later than usual because of Rosh Chodesh, and I want to just finish, so those who feel that they need to go would be welcome to. Says the Maharal, famous discussion in the Gemara that Rabbi Shechter brought up earlier, which is that it says a Bezdin that killed every 7 years, Pam B'Shavua, was called a murderous Bezdin. And there was another opinion which said once every 70 years. But that the Gemara was ambiguous about. On the one hand, one opinion said that if they killed once every 70 years, they're considered to be a destructive Bezdin. And on the other hand, the other one said, no, they do need to be a Bezdin that kills once every 70 years. If they do it once every 7 years, if they don't do it once every 70 years, then it's not good. And the idea is that once every 7 years is like a cycle, right? Shemitah, sabbatical cycle. So a Bezdin that kills once in 7 years is killing regularly. And we feel that if they're killing regularly, then perhaps this mandate of tzedek, this tzidkus, this righteousness of people who ultimately want to do the tov, that's the clear tov, that's the easy tov, that ra, getting rid of ra is last resort. It's not such a last resort for them if it's happening so regularly. On the other hand, right? So some say even once in 70 years, because 70 years means in every generation they're killing. And that might also be considered regularly. 70 is, you know, considered the lifespan. But the others say no. And this is a counter opinion which is found in the Gemara, even if not in this, when there were those who said, right, Rabbi Akiva said, you know, in my time I would not have, nobody would ever have been killed in our Bezdin. So they said to them, one second, but then there's no din. Then Bezdin is just tzedek, just stucca, and no judgment. And while you have to demonstrate a reticence to harm, but you can't demonstrate an avoidance, an ultimate absolute avoidance of doing that, which needs to be done. This is the idea. So again, two notions. One, the reason, the basic idea is because this would be out of character for the way a Bezdin is supposed to function. And there are two elements of character that the Maharal points to that are necessary here. One element of the character is that a Bezdin has to realize they're human beings working to discover humanly, divine wisdom and real accurate truth. And that doesn't come naturally. So it has to show a process. There has to be a visible process of deliberation. And if it comes too quickly, while again we're not challenging that therefore the din is not correct, but again, it's out of character for the way the Bezdin is supposed to be working deliberately through judgment. And the second character is that a Bezdin has to be showing that there are people who are tzaddikim, who ultimately want to do good, that that's their character, that's their character out of Bezdin. And to some degree, that influences the whole nature of things. Just like we say by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? This sounds awfully liberal, doesn't it? But what does Hashem say? What do we say on Yom Kippur? I don't want the person to die. I want him to do tshuva. I'm going to wait until the last minute, till the last possibility. I'm going to leave the door open till the last second. And this, by the way, is something which is very important to recognize in this process. Because a Bezdin is not judging after the fact. A Bezdin is judging in the middle of the process of trying to make, right, in life. They're deciding whether life should end and we're going to give up on this person as a Rasha, or whether we're going to give him a chance further. And that's part of, in a sense, their agency is to, do we have to end the game, so to speak, for HaKadosh Baruch Hu and say, now you have to give up on this person, he ain't going to do tshuva. Part of the role of the Bezdin is in that way. There's much more that's in here in this topic, much more that the Maharal alludes to, but I think this is the basic notions, the basic ideas in terms of how he sees this limitation on the Beis Din. Yes. Anybody who wants to go, please.
I will. You know, there's a Mishnah, Havidah is called on Chav Zchus. I'm not hearing any lesson of that a person should be Muchzak Naki, comes to the Beis Din.
Right.
Now, looking for another way to approach this, as opposed to saying that Beis Din is no type of Midas Rachami, as opposed to saying, no, the person comes to the Beis Din, and he's presumed, he has a presumption, he's a Yid.
It's not true. The Mishnah says in Havidonis Kalavim Kapskos, but the Mishnah says Kshayim Nimufanecha. Right? You be Necha Kirishoy. When they stand before you, you have to look at them like Rishoy. In other words, you're discerning them. You have to assume that they're evil, and you have to be very, very questioning and very, very doubting of everything along the way. And then when they accept it, then they become tzaddik.
Only when you have two bali din before you, in order to that. So that you